Between 10 months and 6 years of age, enslaved conjoined twins, Millie Christine, would be sold at least three times, forced into freak shows in the United States and England. But their life story took a dramatic turn when they were 14 years old. Newfound freedom allowed them to take control of their career, made them one of the most beloved performance duos of the 19th century, who are rarely talked about today. This is the story of the Carolina twins, Millie Christine McCoy. This is Southern Mysteries.
It's gonna be all right. These ain't dark or troubled times. It's a day like any other day. You got a dark and troubled mind, all right. You hold that baby tight, and I swear if you can hear me, then everything gonna be just fine, all right. Oh.
Welcome to Southern Mysteries, exploring historical mysteries and legendary figures of the American South. I'm your host, Shannon Ballard. Throughout history, they've been referred to as the Carolina Nightingales, the two-headed nightingale, the eighth wonder of the world, and simply the Carolina Twins. But to Millie and Christine McCoy, they were Millie Christine, two hearts that beat as one. The McCoy twins were born into slavery in the town of Welch's Creek, North Carolina, on July 11th of 1851. Their parents, Jacob and Monemia, were enslaved by plantation owner Jabez McKay. On the night the twins were born, their mother was assisted by a nurse known as Old Aunt Hannah. She had assisted Monemia during the birth of each of her seven children, five boys and two girls. Decades later, Millie Christine would write of their birth in a pamphlet they published to tell the story of their life in their own words. They wrote that when they entered the world, Old Aunt Hannah told their parents that unlike Monemia's other babies, the twins were in questionable shape. They were conjoined, their bodies fused together at the lower back with a joint pelvis. The twins each had two arms and two legs. But they were healthy and strong. Jacob and Monemia celebrated their birth, and in their words, celebrated that a child was born. That's how Millie Christine's family always referred to her, as one person. And as the years passed, the twins would prefer to be known by their unified rather than separate name. The twins' owner, Jabez McKay, offered special care that would lead to a unique journey for a Black disabled woman who was a slave in the South. From infancy, Millie Christine did not live in the slave quarters on the plantation. She lived in the big house, where she received specialized care. Millie Christine's presence on the plantation drew curious onlookers from the time she was born. Word began to spread that Siamese twins, as they were commonly called at this time, had been born at Welch's Creek, and people wanted to see them. Conjoined twins are genetically identical. They develop from the same egg and, more often than not, share vital organs and limbs. In the 19th and early 20th century, conjoined twins were more often referred to as Siamese twins after Chang and Ing Bunker. Conjoined twins born in 1811 in Siam, which is modern-day Thailand. Chang and Ing toured the world as entertainers for a few years when their managers brought them to America in 1829 to be displayed in freak shows. They made a lot of money, and within 3 years took control of their careers and livelihoods, which was no small feat for those who were malformed or stood out from the rest of society. Freak shows were often their only means of income. The Siamese twins traveled in shows that proclaimed them as spectacles and medical wonders until 1839, when they settled down in Mount Airy, North Carolina. They became U.S. citizens, married sisters, and fathered 21 children. The men also owned slaves, which accounted for part of their wealth in the antebellum South. After the Civil War, they lost a majority of that wealth and died within hours of one another at the age of 62. Now, Millie Christine would face challenges that were unique even to conjoined twins. She would become famous within the freak show circuit, but she would also be leased and sold several times to men who saw her as a means to an end, and even be kidnapped and swept away to another country. In the 1800s, conjoined twins were considered medical freaks of nature. Anyone born a freak, as it was known in the 19th century, were considered monsters with bodies that deviated from the norm. Their physical appearance was something to be gawked at, made fun of. Performers who were given an opportunity to earn a living, often a desperate measure, because it meant taking part in these normally demeaning shows. People would pay to simply gawk at conjoined twins, giants, little people, bearded ladies, anyone who was considered just different. Freak show managers and showmen would meet the subject that was being considered for the show and would require a medical examination to prove this person had physical abnormalities and was not what organizers called a humbug. Humbugs were people who tried to fake malformations in order to gain a place in the show and earn money. Once a doctor authenticated a freak, they would be added to the shows and exhibitions that traveled the country. The freak would usually have a manager or someone who negotiated their pay with the show organizers to ensure they were paid and earned the money they deserved. But there were often performers and people exhibited who had no wish to take part and no option to walk away from the shows. The enslaved men and women in America who were born disabled or viewed in that way by their owner would often be forced to perform in these shows. They had no say in the matter, no rights, and no freedom to simply walk away. In 1841, the showman, P.T. Barnum, realized that people were paying a lot of money to see those who had been born freaks and those who were freak performers, such as fire breathers and sword swallowers. He decided to establish a permanent freak show in his American Museum in New York City and expand the shows to other major cities. Millie Christine McCoy would be forced into exhibition at a Barnum show in Philadelphia after she was kidnapped and sold to several showmen. For the first 14 years of her life, Millie Christine would be controlled by the men who claimed to own her, until she gained freedom that empowered her to use her physical appearance and uniqueness to show the world the beauty of who she was and the gifts she had to offer. But for Millie Christine, it would be a long, hard road to get to that place. One of the most difficult chapters of the life story of Millie Christine is the chapter that reminds us of the disgusting reality of slavery, that owners talked about their slaves as business transactions, much like selling and owning livestock. There was always a question of breeding and how much money an owner could make from their slaves over the course of their life. Jabez McKay saw the twins as moneymakers early on. He knew he would never be able to work Millie Christine as he did other slaves. There would be no housework, no manual labor to make owning them and their mother worth his investment. But as more and more people traveled to his plantation and asked to see the Siamese twins, he realized Millie Christine could bring in a lot of cash for him. When Millie Christine was 10 months old, Jabez McKay began to grow weary of the number of visitors who would continue to show up and ask to see the twins. He decided it was time for Millie Christine to earn her keep. He leased her to a man from South Carolina named John Purvis. Purvis paid McKay $1,000 and agreed that McKay would earn 1/4 of the profits from any exhibition of Millie Christine. Their lease agreement also stated that her mother, Monemia, must accompany Millie Christine on exhibitions, and their mother would be returned to McKay should Purvis decide to sell the twins. 14 months later, when she was 2 years old, Millie Christine was sold to a showman known as Brower, who paid an estimated $8,000 for her. Brower did not have that amount of cash on hand, so he arranged a financial backer. A wealthy man named Joseph Smith co-signed a promissory note. This sale meant Millie Christine was separated from her mother, who had to return to McKay in North Carolina when Brower and Smith took Millie Christine to New Orleans. In New Orleans, Millie Christine underwent the first of hundreds of scientific medical exams she would be subjected to over the course of her life. These exams were required for anyone appearing in a freak show, proof that the performer was not a humbug. Brower was excited to exhibit Millie Christine, but his reputation as a showman was questioned when the exhibitions proved to be failures, brought in very little cash. This made Brower hungry for the money that would come from selling Millie Christine. His desperation led him to fall for a con when a Texan, claiming to be an exhibitor, offered him land valued at $42,000 as payment for Millie Christine. Brower quickly accepted the offer with the condition the deed to the land be delivered to him within 24 hours. He immediately turned over the twins to the Texan, which he regretted 2 days later when he realized no deed was being delivered to him. Brower tried to track down Millie Christine and the Texan, but would later say he covered his tracks so well, he knew he had been beaten. He traveled to the Carolinas to inform Monemia that Millie Christine had been kidnapped. Brower met with his financial backer, Joseph Smith, who agreed to pay the promissory note in full to Jabez McKay. This meant Joseph Smith was now the legal owner of Millie Christine. Smith then set about finding Millie Christine, hiring a well-known 19th century detective, Mr. T.A. Vestal. The detective worked the case for 2 years, constantly checking newspapers from around the country for any mention of Millie Christine or female conjoined twins. When she was exhibited, it would make the newspapers, which offered Vestal leads on how to track Millie Christine and her kidnappers, who exhibited her for a year. All the while, Mr. Vestal was traveling the country, chasing lead after lead for Millie Christine, trying to catch up to her and bring her home. Millie Christine was young and unable to speak for herself. Even if she had been of age, no one would have believed enslaved black twin children over the man who was posing as their white owner. Millie Christine was sold again to a freak show manager who took her to Philadelphia, where she was exhibited in a P.T. Barnum museum. As Vestal made his way to Philadelphia to reclaim Millie Christine for his client, Joseph Smith, he received word that the twins were now in the hands of two men, a showman, William Thompson, and his business partner, a professor by the name of W.J.L. Millar. They claimed they had found Millie Christine in Boston and took her in to care for her, a claim no one believed. The twins were 3 years old now, and when Millie Christine began to speak, it was clear she was from the South, which led to some legal trouble for Millar and Thompson. Now, there are multiple accounts of how Millie Christine would end up on a ship sailing for England. Some say a concerned woman heard her speak, realized she was from the South and had been stolen away to a free state. In an effort to gain freedom for Millie Christine, this woman asked the court to appoint her guardian over the twins. Another account says an angry man claimed to be the owner of Millie Christine and petitioned the court to have the twins returned to him so he could return south with his property. All we know for sure is that W.J.L. Millar and William Thompson fled Philadelphia, setting sail for Liverpool with Millie Christine in 1855. The twins would turn 4 years old while en route to Liverpool. The professor and the showman immediately had Millie Christine examined by doctors in Liverpool to confirm the twins were conjoined. Millar and Thompson then exhibited Millie Christine in Liverpool and would expand their exhibits to London, Sheffield, Leeds, and Birmingham. Thompson and Millar argued over their partnership and exhibitions. Millar decided to take things into his own hands, and he stole Millie Christine, fleeing to Dundee, Scotland. Thompson fought back, and Millie Christine would be caught in the middle of this battle to regain possession of her. Thompson hired prize fighters to kidnap Millie Christine. As Millar tried to grab and hold on to her, the prize fighters were grabbing Millie Christine, trying to wrestle her away from Millar, who said all he heard as those prize fighters ran away with her was the sound of Millie Christine sobbing. This violence and the fighting between Millar and Thompson would ultimately lead to Millie Christine being reunited with her family. Millar believed he was Millie Christine's owner and pursued legal action against Thompson for stealing her. Thompson countered, saying he owned the twins and could use whatever force was necessary to maintain control over his property. Millar set about a different strategy. He began searching for Millie Christine's mother. He felt he would be able to convince an enslaved woman to confirm he was the true guardian of the twins, and in turn, convince the courts in England to order his property returned to him. Millar would learn that Joseph Smith of North Carolina was the true and legal owner of Millie Christine in September of 1855. Millar corresponded with Smith for 14 months, asking him to find Millie Christine's family and sail to England. Millar believed he and Smith could form a lucrative partnership if they worked together to reclaim Millie Christine. Over the next 14 months, Smith purchased Millie Christine's parents, Jacob and Monimia, along with their 7 remaining children, and brought them to his plantation. He knew that if he decided to partner with Millar, he would need to take Monimia with him to England to appear before the court to prove she was the mother of the twins, and that he, Joseph Smith, owned the entire family. In January of 1857, Joseph Smith arrived in England with Monimia. They found a poster listing the twins' next exhibition and purchased tickets to the show. Millar's attorney accompanied them and instructed Monimia that she should remain calm when she saw Millie Christine. Now keep in mind, she had not seen her twins since they were 2 years old. They were now 6. How could a mother contain herself when her twins had been kidnapped? Monimia was overwhelmed when she saw Millie Christine take the stage. She screamed such a heart-wrenching scream that the crowd rose to see if someone was being harmed. Showman Thompson, who had taken the twins away from Millar, tried to grab Millie Christine and make a run for it. But Joseph Smith had arranged for the chief of police to be in the audience and detain Thompson. Within days, Joseph Smith joined Monimia in court to prove Smith should have custody of Millie Christine, that he was the man who owned them. Smith's attorney asked that Millie Christine, being a minor, be turned over to their mother until the final decision could be made over guardianship. The judge declared there would be no need to carry on with a legal battle because it was clear to him that Millie Christine bore a striking likeness to their mother, Monimia. He ordered that Millie Christine be returned to their mother and their party should travel from England to America with their owner, Joseph Smith. Millar made a desperate offer to try to convince Monimia to remain in England and allow Millie Christine to continue to take part in exhibitions. He offered her a new and exciting life, $10,000 and a grand home, if Monimia remained in England until Millie Christine was 18 years old. But Monimia refused. She knew Millar was most likely lying to her and would not keep his word once Joseph Smith sailed to America. She told Millar she wanted to go home and enjoy a reunion of her whole family now that Millie Christine had been found. Joseph Smith sailed back to South Carolina with Millie Christine and Monemia, and the twins were reunited with the rest of their family. But their return to American soil did not lead to freedom for Millie Christine. It meant a different existence for her, with Millie Christine later writing that Joseph Smith and his wife showed great kindness and helped her discover the gifts that would improve her life in the years to come. Once Millie Christine settled back into life with her family, Joseph Smith began exhibiting her for friends who came to the plantation and asked to see her. Smith was very particular and protective of Millie Christine, which was a different experience for the twins who had been owned and managed by men who mistreated them, forced them to undergo excruciating medical exams, and by all accounts, assaults over the course of the first 6 years of her life. The Smiths expanded exhibitions of the twins to southern states in the late 1850s, including shows in South Carolina, Georgia, Florida, Louisiana, and Mississippi. It seems an odd thing to say, considering Millie Christine was enslaved by the Smiths, but her experience was unique. She had never known the hard labor of those who were enslaved on the plantation and had been so mistreated and abused by the men who continued to sell her and only cared to profit from her that it must have felt like something new and different. The feeling of being protected and secure again was comforting, even if that feeling came from the very couple who owned her. Joseph Smith and his wife did work to ensure that Millie Christine received an education. She learned how to read and write in 5 languages. She also learned to dance and sing and became an accomplished pianist. All of these skills were displayed in her shows until 1861. The Civil War brought about domestic troubles, as Mr. Smith would explain to interested parties who wanted to exhibit Millie Christine in the South even in the early days of the Civil War. Mr. Smith explained that he and his family, including Millie Christine, had to withdraw from public life for the duration of the war. They sought refuge and hid out in their home in Spartanburg, South Carolina. In November of 1862, Joseph Smith became ill and died, leaving behind his wife and children who grieved his loss, along with Millie Christine, who wrote in her memoir that she was heartbroken by the loss of a man who had shown her such kindness. Mrs. Smith would remain in Spartanburg with her family and slaves until the war ended. She was adamant that they stay because, as Millie Christine's family would later explain, there had been rumors that General Sherman's army had been ordered to find those Carolina twins and free them. With the end of the war in 1865, Millie Christine was free from slavery, but chose to remain with the Smith family. In a somewhat surprising move, Millie Christine chose not only to remain, but dedicated the years after the war to touring and exhibitions and shows for the express purpose of helping the Smiths retrieve the fallen fortune of the family, with the late Mr. Smith's son, Joseph Smith Jr., serving as their manager. Now, this decision was a shock to many who felt Millie Christine should have fled the Smith home and embraced her freedom. What folks sometimes miss is that Millie Christine did embrace her freedom. She embraced her freedom by making her own choices. Millie Christine explained her decision to remain in the home of Mrs. Smith, saying that she could trust her. She felt grateful for her, even regarded Mrs. Smith and her family with true affection. But this kindness and affection toward Mrs. Smith did not mean Millie Christine was beholden to her. At the age of 14, Millie Christine asserted her newfound independence and used her gifts of singing and dancing to tour again on her own terms. Now, her terms for touring were as follows. First, Millie Christine kept the money she earned. Her manager made a portion of the profits from the shows to help his own family. Otherwise, the money was Millie Christine's. Second, there would be no more medical examinations. At this point, she had been subjected to so many exams that Millie Christine felt it was easy to obtain medical records or speak directly to doctors who examined her if a show manager needed authentication of her unique physical form. Taking control of her life and exhibitions led to a great financial reward and fame for Millie Christine's shows, in which Millie's alto blended beautifully with Christine's soprano as they sang and danced. As word of Millie Christine's shows spread and positive reviews were printed, demand increased. Within a few years, the twins were bringing in about $6,000 a week, performing for thousands. Wherever she traveled, Millie Christine made it clear that she viewed herself as one person. Conductors at railroad lines were sent messages ahead of Millie Christine's travels and instructed to issue one ticket for the, quote, dual woman. Millie Christine learned there was a great demand for shows in Europe, and within a few years of returning to the touring circuit, she set about a European tour that would expand and last 7 years. Early in the tour, she experienced what she would call a remarkable moment in her life. On June 24th of 1871, Millie Christine met Queen Victoria, who requested a meeting and private performance. The twins obliged, singing duets for the Queen. Millie Christine's tours would take her to many other countries, including France, Germany, Russia, and Belgium, and always back home to America. Throughout her decades of touring, she would take in countless private exhibitions, some circus shows organized by P.T. Barnum, and many museum exhibitions that led to great wealth and financial security for the twins. At the height of her career, Millie Christine would make an estimated $25,000 for one season on the county fair circuit. That wealth afforded Millie Christine the opportunity to make a very meaningful purchase. She purchased the old Jabez McKay plantation, where her parents had been enslaved and where she had been born into slavery. She then had a 10-room house built on the land and gifted it to her father, Jacob. Upon his death, Jacob willed the plantation to his wife, children, and grandchildren, ensuring that Millie Christine and her siblings would always have a place to live and call home in North Carolina. Around 1900, Millie Christine's intense touring schedule began to take a toll on her health. She made the decision to retire to the family home in Welch's Creek, North Carolina, and would remain free of the spotlight for the remainder of her life. For the next decade, Millie Christine lived a simple and quiet life. She poured her heart and soul into the community. She founded a school for Black children and supported a number of colleges. But the condition for her patronage was that the gifts always remain anonymous. In 1909, Millie Christine was devastated by the loss of decades of mementos of her career and travels when a fire burned her beloved home. The night the house burned, Millie Christine was forced to sit outside and watch as the house was consumed by fire. It was a cold night, and her family maintained to this day that the exposure to the fire and the cold rain that evening led to Millie Christine's health being compromised and her diagnosis of terminal tuberculosis, which would ultimately lead to her death. It would be Millie who passed away first on October 8, 1912. Christine would tell their doctor that she felt Millie pass away in a peaceful dream. Christine could not be separated from Millie, nor would she have wished for that. In the hours following Millie's passing, Christine prayed and sang as she knew her time was near. Her prayers were for release so she could be reunited with Millie. 8 hours later, her prayers were answered. Millie Christine's last will and testament made her wishes clear. She did not want to be separated following her death, did not want an autopsy or any form of medical exam after she passed away. She requested cremation, but her family chose to prepare a specially designed coffin and bury her in the family graveyard. There had been concerns that grave robbers would steal Millie Christine's body and sell her remains for experiments. This fear led her family to station guards at her burial site for a year after her death. When they felt Millie Christine could be at peace, they placed a marker at her gravesite. It was inscribed, "A soul with two thoughts, two hearts that beat as one." Millie Christine shared in her memoir that there was one simple song she performed that was always requested by fans. Perhaps because the lyrics so directly conveyed how she felt about her life. Two heads, four arms, four feet, all in one perfect body meet. I am most wonderfully made. All scientific men have said, none like me since days of Eve. None such, perhaps, will ever live. A marvel to myself am I, as well as all who passes by. I'm happy quite, because I'm good. I love my Savior and my God. I love all things God has done, whether I'm created, two or one. Southern Mysteries is hosted and produced by me, Shannon Ballard. You can read Millie Christine's firsthand account of the pamphlet she published, known as The History of the Carolina Twins, Told in Their Own Peculiar Way. Reading it gives you a glimpse of her intelligence, wit, and humor. You'll find a link to the pamphlet the twins released in the show notes for this episode at southernmysteries.com. That's where you can also view photos of Millie Christine. Now, if you're enjoying Southern Mysteries, I'd ask you to support the show in a couple of ways. First, subscribe so you always know when there's a new episode, and leave a review in your player so people know to follow your lead and check out Southern Mysteries. Second, become a member of the show on Patreon. There are a few membership options, including supporting at the Lanyep level, which means you get a little something extra, bonus content each month, as a thanks for your ongoing support of this independent podcast. You can learn about membership at patreon.com/southernmysteries. You'll also find that link in the show notes where you're listening now. I want to say a special thanks to Stacy K from Santa Rosa, California, who became our very first member on Patreon. Thank you, Stacy, for your faithful support of the show. And to anyone who has rated and reviewed Southern Mysteries or simply shared about the show with a friend, I appreciate your help in spreading the word about Southern Mysteries. Thanks so much for listening.